Hey folks, producer Matt here, just to warn you that up top there's a little bit of a sound issue with Sam's mic, but it is sorted out a matter of seconds later, so should be all sorted out for tomorrow.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, March 14th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, investigative reporter at The Intercept, author of Code Over Country, The Tragedy and Corruption of SEAL Team 6, Matthew Cole will be joining us. And then we'll talk to Jack Crosby, writer at the Discourse blog, correspondent at Rolling Stone magazine, also co-writer of Majority Report's AM Quickie on his reporting from Ukraine. Also on the program, Russia bombs Western Ukrainian military base 11 miles from the Polish border. White House approves another $200 million in weapons to Ukraine as the so-called self-appointed problem solvers in Congress call for even more weapon sales. American reporter killed in Ukraine. Meanwhile, leaked memo from the Kremlin emphasized the need to use Tucker Carlson for Russian propaganda. I'm clipping. You got to bring me down. Texas courts issue injunction on Texas law targeting parents who seek medical care for transgender kids. China puts a northern province into near lockdown over an Omicron outbreak. Should also say a Texas Supreme Court shuts down the final challenge to that Texas abortion ban. Yesterday, a two-year anniversary of the killing of Breonna Taylor. And today is the 139th anniversary. Maybe we got our math wrong. Not sure. Of when Karl Marx died. Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. Apologize for our audio snafus. Hopefully it has been fixed at the moment. Still working on these things.
It's going to be a lot better soon, though, folks.
Going to be a lot better soon. We're working through this. Oh, that is the voice of Matt Leck, who has returned from his vacation
There he is.
I'm back in the seat.
Back in the seat. We greeted him with a huge pile of wires. Said, fix this. And so we just had to work out the new levels. The gain is too high for both you and Leck, Train Boy says, who I met the other day at, I saw again the other day at the live podcast of the Bituation Room. I don't know if we call it a podcast. Live show. Bituation Room. Hopefully that's a little bit better.
Train Boy is also a podcast boy. He likes to go to podcast stuff. I've seen him at our live shows
before. Yes, yes. I didn't mean to say meet. I meant to say again. Hopefully our audio is better. Can we get some feedback maybe from Dorsey can help on that. Meanwhile, just one note, I got an email from a listener, Tim, and in response to a segment we did about Laura Ingraham the other day, Laura Ingraham was doing a piece where she was talking about the idea that that gay people would in any way let younger elementary school kids know that they were gay or that 5- and 6-year-olds would get any type of education in the schools that dealt with their bodily autonomy, feeling good about themselves. You got to pull me down a little bit more. Bodily autonomy, those type of issues. And during the course of that segment, I said, I'm paraphrasing, but something to the effect of like, you know, the vast majority of people will become sexual beings, human beings, as they get older. So they're not being taught to be sexual. They're being taught aspects of their sexuality, which is going to come naturally. And at one point, I said something to the effect of people who are well-adjusted. There are people, and Tim points this out for me, there are people who grow up or who are born asexual and continue to be asexual, and I did not mean to stigmatize folks like that. Vast majority of people are sexual, but that is not nothing wrong with you psychologically if you happen to be one of those people or kids or adults who are asexual. And I just want to make that clear. And I appreciate, Tim catching that for me and apologize for not making that clear and noting that in the moment of that segment. So appreciate the feedback there. As we said in the headlines, the Russian assault on Ukraine continues unabated. There continue to be talks. They are at this point really going nowhere. Russians bombed a base about 11 miles from the Polish border where there had been NATO exercises, or I shouldn't say NATO exercises, but NATO states that came in and provided training for Ukrainian soldiers, I think, at one point, not at this time. And so the conflict continues. There is pressure for Biden coming from some of the war hawks in the Senate to provide fighter jets to Ukraine. We just sent another $200 million worth of weapons, or the White House okayed that. Here is former ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. He is on the Rachel Maddow show. This clip has gone viral and with good reason. And we're seeing a lot of, well, let's listen to his clip here.
And I want to just say one other thing. I was just on Ukrainian television just 30 minutes ago. Brave journalists, just like our team covering the war there in Kiev. And one of the commentators said something interesting about how horrific this war is. And remember, these are people who suffered under fascism that fought the Nazis. As the Nazis came and then the Red Army came back through. One of the Russian journalists said, you know, there's one difference between Hitler when he was coming in and Putin. Hitler didn't kill ethnic Germans. He didn't kill German-speaking people. That's a very, I think people need to remember that when we're talking about cities like Kharkiv and Mariupol and Kiev, there are large populations there, up to a third and sometimes as much to a half that are Russian speakers and are ethnic Russians. And yet Putin doesn't seem to care about that. He slaughters the very people he said he has come to liberate.
There's a lot of things that are problematic about this moment here. Now, some people have said, well, he's just quoting somebody else, but he's quoting somebody else because he's just found somebody who said what he wanted to say in a more articulate way than he brought up, or he agrees with the sentiment. First off, you don't need to say what Putin is doing is wrong when you see images of them bombing Ukrainians by
saying that Hitler wasn't even as this bad. You don't need to do that. It's also just an absurd claim at this point. Tens of millions of people died in World War II. Without even getting into the specifics, it's an insane claim at this point. It also implies, well, let me get to that in a moment. And then we should also say, it's also not true. I don't know. You want to talk about just the Jews in Germany. I've got some news from Eckhart Fault. Guess what language they spoke? Many of them spoke German. In fact, a huge number of them spoke German. They had been emancipated from the I guess, religious world in Germany in like the 1830s, I think it was. But we should also say, like, this comparison is done to imply that Putin will not stop with Ukraine, that this is a juggernaut that is going to blow through Europe. I mean, because that's what Hitler did. And if this guy's worse than Hitler, I don't think that there's anyone who genuinely believes this. It may have been the case that Putin had designs on other former, I want to say Soviet republics, but, you know, I think it has more to do with the Russian Empire. But regardless, but it's quite clear that the plan's not going the way that it meant to. You don't need to say that this is worse than World War II or has the potential to be, because it won't unless that type of rhetoric is promoted, in which case we could end up engaging in a World War III. So there was all, I mean, the amount of things that were wrong with that were, you know, pretty astonishing. And then I don't even know how to like interpret this. Michael McFaul then gets on Twitter and says, after a long, I guess he meant to say evening, he sort of dropped that, of commentary that started with Morning Joe and end with Maddow, I slipped late last night and violated an unwritten taboo. Look, this is not even like, let me start with an excuse that is also sort of like a humble brag. And then let me go into saying, like, I made a boo-boo and I violated an unwritten taboo. In other words, I violated something that is really sort of like, I mean, when you think about the word taboo, right?
Like superstitious.
Yes. You, the implication is in some way like, oh, this is something that is really a reflection of people's problems more than that they impose on society more than this was not. I don't know what the taboo is. And oh, here he goes. He tells us never compare Hitler with anyone. No, actually, you can compare Hitler with other people, but don't make ridiculous, stupid comparisons, one that are meant to generate a war lust. And then he goes on to say, I agree. He was incomparably evil. I won't do it again. And okay, but that's not, I mean, yeah, okay. But you also were wrong on the facts in your comparison. And then he followed up with, to those who wrote me to explain Hitler committed the same atrocities against ethnic Germans that Putin is committing. I don't know what he means by, I don't know what he's trying to say by ethnic Germans. I guess here is where he's trying to say, like, not Jewish people,
right,
who were born in Germany, who were German citizens, who were German. They were German Jews. And I don't know what he's saying, ethnic Russians in Ukraine. I don't understand what the point is he's talking about here. Now, of course, there were also German Germans, or I guess, I don't know what ethnic Germans mean, but there were ethnic Germans that Hitler, but here he is now trying to split. Now he's not only not like sort of like pulling back on his apology, he's now just sort of saying like, but I was actually right. Against ethnic Russians today in Mariupol in Kharkiv, please suggest to me, I guess he meant suggest to me, the best scholarly readings on history. I'm eager to learn. Now, if it's the case that our ambassador to Russia does not know where to go outside of Twitter for scholarly work on the history of Hitler's assault on Germans, that's really puts makes us question, why is this guy on from Morning Joe to Maddow talking about this? But really what it is, it's more about him saying, him just being, this is also part of my non-apology, which is to say like, oh, if you think you're so smart, point to me a citation in a book that uses the term, I don't even know if you could find it, ethnic Germans, where you can show me the sentence, Hitler bombed ethnic Germans. It's conceivable there were ethnic Germans living in Poland, ethnic Germans living in England and in France and in other places. I don't know what he's trying to, you know, you made a mistake, apologize, and then walk away. But the arrogance of these people and the arrogance, he's gone on to other places and talking about, like, you know, this whole thing about World War III is a little overblown. I mean, honestly,
demonstrate some credibility on stuff first before you start reassuring me about World War III. Thank you.
Absolutely nuts. Absolutely nuts. All right. In a minute, we're going to be talking to Matthew Cole and then later Jack Crosby. Hey, folks, job market still going strong. Many people have switched their jobs during this great resignation, and they're looking for better jobs, looking for better pay, and that's a good thing. But how are you going to find the right person to work for you? Well, you can do what we did here at the Majority Report when we were fishing around for a new producer back in the day. I think ZipRecruiter had advertised with us. I had never used it, although I played around with it. And we used it, and ultimately that's how we got Brendan on the show, through ZipRecruiter. And ZipRecruiter's artificial intelligence, it's always learning. So if you're hiring, their AI gets better and faster at finding the right candidates for all your roles. Right now, you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. Then it proactively presents these candidates to you. ZipRecruiter, I think, actually reached out and brought brought the job to Brendan, and Brendan came to us that way. You can easily review these recommended candidates, invite your top choices to apply for your job, which encourages them to apply faster. They have a great, what is that? User interface, UI, and organizes everything for you, makes hiring so much easier. It's no wonder ZipRecruiter, it's the number one rated hiring site in the U.S. based on G2 ratings. Now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y. ZipRecruiter, it is the smartest way to hire. Also, it's been a rough couple of years, as you know, continues to be rough, frankly, in many respects. You got stress, anxiety, fatigue. Question is, are they eroding your mental health? I would probably bet yes.
So the question is, how fast?
Exactly. Well, the question is, what can you do on a daily basis that will have a huge impact on your long-term happiness and well-being? You can use Headspace. Headspace is an app. It's scientifically proven to help you manage your feelings and your mental health. In fact, a recent study proved in just 2 weeks of Headspace, you can reduce your stress by 14%. Once you download the Headspace app, you try their mindfulness routines. It takes just a few minutes a day to change your relationship with stress and anxiety to start feeling better. Doesn't matter if you want to relieve stress or anxiety or sleep better or improve your focus, Headspace is your everyday dose of mindfulness for real life. Now, I have said for years that it's very difficult for me to try and do any type of meditation. I can't measure how much less stress I have and this and that, but I can tell you, I will say this. I'm yelling at the kids less. That's basically it. And by kids, I don't mean these guys. I'll work on that. But for me, I do my mindfulness because I can't sit still for any period of time except for when I'm behind a mic talking. When I walk, Headspace has a walking mindfulness meditation that guides you as you're walking. And I do a lot of walking, and it has been incredibly helpful to learn to do that. And I think ultimately my goal is to be able to do this when I'm not moving. It may take a while, but if I get there, it's going to be because of Headspace. However you're feeling, try Headspace at headspace.com/majority and get 1 month free off of their entire mindfulness library. This is the best Headspace offer available. So go to headspace.com/majority today. Headspace.com/majority. We will put these links in our podcast and YouTube descriptions. Check them out. 1 month free at Headspace. Get some free stuff at ZipRecruiter. You're supporting the show, and these are great products, both of them. We need to take a quick break, and when we do, we'll be back with Matthew Cole, investigative reporter at The Intercept, author of Code Over Country, The Tragedy and Corruption of SEAL Team 6. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Matthew Cole. He's an investigative reporter at The Intercept and author of the new book, Code Over Country, The Tragedy and Corruption of SEAL Team 6. Matthew, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
All right, let's start with, I guess the obvious place to start is, you know, where did SEAL Team 6 come from? I mean, what was the genesis of, or actually, even before we get there, What is SEAL Team 6? I mean, I think people, you know, have a vague notion, but where does it fit within the context of our military services?
Sure. It's what the military classifies as a tier one unit. It is a elite organization within or draws from the larger Navy SEALs. So it's a command based at Virginia Beach that's made up of about 300 SEALs who are the top 10% of all SEALs, right? And the only other unit that essentially is their equal is the Army's Delta Force. And they exist in a state of 24-hour readiness at all times. So in other words, they are literally the 300, and they sometimes refer to themselves as the president's own because they deploy when effectively the president authorizes them to leave the country for a mission. That was certainly how they began. So they are the best of the best within Navy special operations and are the best, you know, among the best, if not the best, in the military altogether for special operations. And of course, they're, you know, primarily best known as the unit that killed Osama bin Laden and saved Captain Phillips from the Somali pirates in 2009.
Why are they drawn from the Navy as opposed to another service?
Well, the SEALs come from a long history, starting going back to World War II, of what are called frogmen or Navy combat swimmers. And they were just a portion of the Navy that would at that time deploy off of ships into the Pacific and in Europe to scout for the defenses along a shoreline where Navy forces and Marines were going to land and charge in from the sea. And they did a combination of things, scouting topographically beneath the water to understand, what they had to worry about defensively, and also blow things up with explosives to move things out of the way that might be impediments. And that unit, or there were actually a couple of units at the time, and they eventually coalesced into what became known as the Underwater Demolition Teams, the UDT, and were deployed in the Korean War. And then John F. Kennedy, President Kennedy, authorized a new organization for naval special warfare that became known as the SEALs, the Sea, Air, Land Teams, and that designate, you know, it identifies essentially how they can end up in a mission or a war. They can come by air, they can come by land, and primarily, obviously, they can come by sea. And that differentiates them from every other special operations force with the Army and the Air Force, because obviously water is what the Navy does.
So what is the genesis of, maybe you just gave it to us a little bit there, but when we talk about SEAL Team 6, what was the genesis of this? I mean, part of it, I know, comes out of the Iran, or the fallout from the Iran hostage crisis.
That's right. The there was a failed mission. Some of your viewers may remember, many will not. There was a failed mission in 1979 to get the American hostages who had been held at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran out. At the time, there was a unit then known, actually, I don't remember what it was known then, but it's what we now know as Delta Force, was sent in, and there was a mishap with helicopters and plane at a staging point in the desert. And so afterwards, the Pentagon and then President Carter authorized the creation of a new counterterrorism and hostage rescue capability within the military. That became known as the Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC. And then the Navy was able to add a unit for itself, which became the SEAL Team 6. And it was named, it was intentionally misnamed to throw off, at that time, the Soviet military into thinking that there were more SEAL teams than there were. In fact, there were only two SEAL teams at the time. and they just gave it the number 6. And that was the genesis of how it developed.
It's sort of crazy to think that, like, just by naming it number 6 would be like, oh, well, why, I mean, why didn't we just, why wasn't it like SEAL Team, you know, 1500 or something?
It was random that way. The unit was created by a SEAL officer named Commander Richard Marcinko, who had been a Vietnam veteran, highly decorated. And it was just part of the disinformation to help with its coverage. It was highly classified. It still is highly classified, although you wouldn't necessarily know it from popular culture. And, you know, it was fitting. Fit in with the ethos of trying to, you know, mislead your enemy and your adversary to protect something that was quite secret at the time.
And so, what? Give us a sense. So this starts in the early 80s, I guess. I mean, somewhere around there. I mean, 1980. Where? I mean, the book obviously outlines how the Navy SEALs have become problematic, I guess. I don't know how else. I mean, it's a wide range of problems here. But how did it start? I mean, in terms of, like, what was the idea in terms of its use, and when did things start to go off the rails? Or was it the way that SEAL Team 6 was constructed was already off the rails?
Well, let me go back just slightly to reframe that question. The SEALs themselves, and from, you know, as I was describing the history of what were known euphemistically as frogmen and combat swimmers, were always a very unique breed culturally within the Navy. And in fact, you know, what later became was that they were totally outside of the Navy. They were drawing men who were, by any measure, extremely tough, very brave. You know, their job at the time was to slip off of ships into the sea with nothing more than flippers and goggles and a knife, sometimes with a bag of explosives, right? They were unarmed, and then go and scout the, you know, up close, the defenses of land that the Marines and the Navy were going to try to land and take. It was, you know, it's a hair-raising job, and they had, even then, culturally, this they were self-selecting. You know, they were physically incredibly fit, and they were, you know, essentially within the culture of the larger Navy, they were the rogues. They were pirates. And so in time, that's part of the DNA of what became SEALs. So it's always there. And then you get the development of SEAL Team 6, which is this hyper-specialized, extremely elite unit whose job at the end of the day fundamentally is hostage rescue and killing. I mean, they are within special operations forces and certainly within Navy special operations, they are, you know, the best killers, the most effective, the most judicious. And from their screening process and from their beginning, they have in their DNA, this comes from Dick Marcinko, who just recently died this past Christmas. And, you know, the obituaries referred to him frequently as very colorful. But in fact, he was a lot more than that. He was brilliant. He was profane. He was a liar. He was a killer. He was a fabulist. And he was also an incredible alcoholic. And so at the beginning of SEAL Team 6, one of the standards that was created, you know, unofficially to join the unit was the ability to drink with Dick Marcinko. If you could drink with the skipper and hold your alcohol and you came recommended elsewhere, you were going to make it, right? That was part of, you know, a good portion of the selection process. So at its outset, SEAL Team 6 has this DNA, this imprint that is Commander Marcinko. And as he said to me in interviews on the record before he died, was that he created the unit like a mafia in which he was the Don, he was the godfather, and the, you know, the secrets of the teams had to stay within the teams. Any problems had to, and he had a rationale for it, which was he was trying to stand up a unit that would be ready at any time to answer the president's call to deploy somewhere, you know, around the world to carry out the president's orders. And so he didn't have time to deal with Navy regulations and personnel issues, right? So it had to stay inside. That element, you know, while the unit professionalized enormously after Marcinko and in the decades before 9/11 and obviously since 9/11, that cultural imprint, that DNA is there. It's still there. And it is part of, you know, the subtitle in the book is Tragedy and Corruption. And the subtitle of the book could have been The Secrets of SEAL Team 6, but it's, these men live and operate on a knife's edge, and it requires an enormous amount of discipline and oversight to keep them from going off the rails. And when they don't have that, it's easy for them to slip off. And that's certainly what happened at the beginning of the unit and how they were created. And it absolutely happened once we after 9/11.
What was it about 9/11 that began to, or were there examples, let's say, in the 20 years prior to 9/11 that it was in existence that were indicative of these problems?
Well, yeah, they had, I mean, there were a quiet history of, you know, drug problems, drug use, drug dealing, theft. They, you know, at the beginning, I mean, in fact, actually Marcinko, in a list, I should have added a list of things that Marcinko describes him. He's also a convicted felon. And it came from a fraud scheme that he had cooked up with another former member of the unit. Now, it happened after he was out of SEAL Team 6, but he used SEAL Team 6 as the basis to get a fake contract for grenades. And the reason why it was initially successful and used it was because the procurement system within SEAL Team 6 was had so little oversight by necessity. You know, they had to be able to call up a manufacturer and get something instantly, right? And so everything was sped up much faster than it would be in a larger Navy and certainly within the regular SEAL teams. He used that to try to enrich himself, and he later was convicted and spent a year and change in prison. So those things would pop up from time to time. And then what happens is it's not that there was something about 9/11. It's that 9/11, you know, after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan and the SEALs were inserted, it began 20 years of war and became an unprecedented amount of exposure to war, to, you know, war fighting that any American unit has ever seen. And that's what I think the general public probably doesn't have a sense or a recognition that there is no other time in U.S. history when we sent off men to experience and engage in this much combat. There literally is no precedent for it. And so the effects and the traumas that come with that start to play themselves out throughout the war. And when you have a unit that has this much autonomy, you are, you know, on paper, you're ripe for problems. If you have a unit that has this sort of strain of, you know, lack of accountability, integrity issues, failure to police itself, you get what the title really is, which is a code of silence, a code of corruption that persists, you know, unfortunately, till today.
Where else? I mean, and we'll get to the Green memo in a bit, but how far did that code go? In other words, was there, you know, who was in, I guess, immediate command once you get out of the command structure of SEAL Team 6 itself? Like, where would the accountability rise to? And what was the attitude, I guess, of the Navy at that point, which was like, yes, we're having reports of this or that, but the bottom line is they're getting stuff done. I mean, do we have a sense of what that dynamic was?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you know, even though they are of the Navy, they're not really of the Navy, right? They are attached to and report to JSOC, which is in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And so your immediate, you know, the place that can has a chance to do some policing or oversight and accountability starts there, right? You have a three or four star flag officer who oversees the unit in terms of how it's used and utilized. And then from there, you basically get Congress and the Pentagon. There isn't, you know, there isn't actually by design a lot of red tape. The real issue is that when they've had problems, the main thing is to keep it essentially on the battlefield, right? To keep it at a lower level so that you don't have flag officers who are forced to face with accusations or allegations. If the allegations don't rise, if they remain essentially on the battlefield, investigated there and then covered up, there really isn't a problem. And that's what the unit, you know, for a good 15 years, from 2001 till 2015, really until 2017, when two members of SEAL Team 6 murdered a Green Beret in the West African nation of Mali, is when you sort of the problems at SEAL Team 6 spill out beyond the command in Virginia Beach.
Let's talk about some of those incidents that take place over there. I mean, they range from, the Norgrove, I guess, mission that goes wrong to the killing, like you say, in Mali. What other, maybe tell us about the Norgrove mission as an example of a mission that goes awry, what else are we seeing? And is there a, trajectory in terms of these problems, or is it we just start getting, you know, problems every 6 months, or how does that? I mean,
let me add a little context here, and let's place this in a situate this a little better. First of all, SEAL Team 6 is just like Delta, the premier military unit for special operations. Right, if you were an American held hostage abroad, you absolutely would want SEAL Team 6 to be the guys who are sent in to potentially rescue you. You know, they're incredibly talented. They're really good at what they do. They are the best of the best. And they are, as a majority, great guys. You know, men who are incredibly skilled with plenty of integrity. So we're not talking about, a unit that has nothing but rogues and criminals. What happens is that after 9/11, and where I sort of, you know, what my sources always pointed to post 9/11 was this first battle, first serious battle, and the first death casualty of one of their own that happens in March of 2002 that became known as the Battle of Robert's Ridge early in Afghanistan, war in Afghanistan. And, you know, they lost one of their own. He was mutilated and treated savagely by the enemy. And there was, in the immediate aftermath, a bloodlust, a need for revenge from some of his teammates, not all. And, you know, frankly, looking back on it, it was the first exposure of real up close combat that any of them in the unit had faced, right? There were very few members of SEAL Team 6 who were in Mogadishu for the Black Hawk Down incident in 1993. In many ways, until 9/11 happened, SEAL Team 6 was the JV to Delta Force's varsity in terms of just preference and how often they were used. And so they come to the war, a lot in the same way that most Americans did, right? 9/11 happens, we send our forces in, and we start getting back these images and video and experiences of things that we hadn't seen before, hadn't seen since Vietnam. And so for SEAL Team 6, that story is very similar. And so it goes from there, and it starts, it's deployment after deployment. It's not, to answer your question, was it every 6 months? No, it's as they moved forward and operated, and they were incredibly successful. They were incredibly lethal, and judicious most of the time. They were, not infrequently committing war crimes. There was a lot of bodily desecrations was sort of the thing. But that is just part of the sort of when there were violations of the laws of war or ethical and moral violations. The problem was that the unit could not police itself. I mean, and that part goes for 20 years. I mean, it literally could not police itself. It's kind of phenomenal, actually. And you know, in a lot of ways, you know, I try to say that my book, Code Over Country, is the secrets of SEAL Team 6. But the truth is that nearly everything in the book is very well known inside the SEAL community, inside the special operations community. It's only secret to the public because they've been so successful, and the military, it's not just them, the larger military has been so successful at branding the Navy SEALs and SEAL Team 6 as this unambiguously heroic unit and group of men who, you know, can fire three shots and take down three people simultaneously, you know, sort of godlike and heroic. And it the truth and the necessary truth is much, much more problematic and troubling. And, you know, that was the genesis of the book.
And that's what led Rear Admiral Colin Green, who looked at a review. Apparently there was a review that said things are fine, more or less. And he rebuked that review. Tell us just how that happened. And presumably when he says we have a problem, that's what he's talking about. There is no, these things happen, but there is no, we have no way to, there's no accountability, and we have no way of like, of imposing any type of discipline on this unit.
Yeah, well, so when he was speaking specifically, it was about the larger naval special warfare. So it includes SEAL Team 6 and then the rest of the what they call the white side of the Navy SEALs, the less classified. But it's important to remember that the SEAL Team 6 is, it's the very top of the SEAL community, right? So what happens there, what starts there, trickles down. Because if you are a regular non-SEAL Team 6 member of SEAL, the SEAL community, they're the ones who are idolized. That's a position that many, you know, strive to get into because it is the best of the best, and they get the most funding and the most training. And so you have, and as a SEAL, you get more pay if you're in SEAL Team 6. To answer that question, I'll just go back 1 second to the question before, which is that historically, and really up until the moment that Admiral Colin Green writes to his force and says, we have a problem, every time there was some kind of incident, that allegation, you know, problem, the SEALs and SEAL Team 6 were very successful in describing it as a one-off, a singular bad apple who had done something, a one-time event where circumstances were, you know, sort of a perfect storm of ingredients led to this thing. And what what Green finally was able to articulate was, and it was in very few words because, you know, this was public and unclassified, was that, no, this problem is more than just one incident. There's a virus here in our community that has started long before this ever occurred. And it sort of flares up, you know, whether it flares up every 6 months or every 6 weeks, they're part of the same problem, right? It's not that, you know, every incident is directly related to the other, but it is this cultural issue, which exists to this day, as I say, in which when problems happen, the first instinct is to circle the wagons, keep it within the team, and cover it up, right? They will mete out accountability and punishment on the individual level within their group, but they will not let the outside world or anyone above them know what really went on. And so the culture of lying, of, you know, lying by omission and otherwise just, you know, directly lying, is incredibly strong. I mean, really strong. And it's notable. I will say this as an outsider. I think one of the things that surprised me most in all the years of reporting that I've done about SEAL Team 6 and the SEALs is that this is one of the trademark characteristics within the military, outside of the SEALs, of the SEALs, is the lack of integrity and the dishonesty. And it's sort of, you know, you sort of, and I'm a father with three kids, and you sort of say, if you you know, you let your kid continue to lie, or you don't provide some kind of you know, discipline, what do your kids learn, right? And that's what we're looking at with the SEALs 20 years into the post 9/11 wars into the forever wars, is that the only lesson that they've learned is that as long as they're successful on the battlefield, they'll get away with it. And they have.
So what is being done, if anything, and if and what should be done at this point, and where will we be in 20 years if it's not done?
Oh, that's a great question, a great series of questions. I think the in talking to, you know, it's important to remember, and I think as I do interviews about the book, you know, there is a lot of criticism of, I wouldn't say a lot, but there's criticism of, oh, I must be anti-SEAL. I must hate the SEALs, or I must hate the men and women who wear uniforms. And of course, it couldn't be further from the truth. This kind of investigative journalism comes from people inside the community, senior members of SEAL Team 6 with 20 and in some cases 30 years inside, who tried to fix things and couldn't. And so they eventually turn, of course, to journalists, as they, you know, as they should, I think. And in interviews with them over the years, I've asked this question, well, what should be done? What can be done? No one within the SEAL community was calling for, is calling for, you know, their peers to go to jail and to be tried for criminal activity and looking back in the euphemism of our day. There is a notion that there is either needs to be some kind of sort of reconciliation or a mandate to present a investigation into the history of SEAL Team 6 and the SEALs with the proviso that no one is going to be punished, but for instance, perhaps end the careers. I mean, it's like a truth and reconciliation tribunal. And the Australians and their special forces had a similar problem, and they've done something like that. They did a huge report that they made public, and it was they were calling for criminal investigations or at least referrals to them. It doesn't look like any of that'll happen. But what it certainly did is it ended careers, and that's the first step. Is that there is a whole generation of Navy SEAL Team 6 officers whose careers should end, not because they're fired, but just end naturally, you know, just no more going up. And there's probably an entire generation beneath them that came up under them that have to also just be pushed aside. That's the first step. The second step would normally be, you know, you'd have to have congressional committees, the Senate and House Armed Services Committee, open this up and look at this along with the Navy. There is a admiral now, a two-star named Wyman Howard, who is currently the commanding officer of Naval Special Warfare out in Coronado, who has implemented some changes that are positive, largely having to do with trimming down the size of the force and how much is deployed. But there is a great irony in he replaced Admiral Green in 2020, and he was a commander at SEAL Team 6 who procured custom-made hatchets for his men, who took them out onto the battlefield and used them, not all of them, but they were used to desecrate bodies. He rose to becoming commander of SEAL Team 6. He's obviously at great heights with two stars. And so it's very much a case of the Navy putting the fox in to guard the hen house. And, you know, when he was originally tapped to get the job, I got calls from officers and the enlisted on the inside, from SEALs, who couldn't believe that this was their choice for cleaning up, right? He had a mandate to clean up the SEALs and fix this stuff. And it's not possible when you were part of the problem and certainly emblematic of the corruption, the cultural corruption at SEAL Team 6 and the larger Navy SEAL team community. So it's another example, unfortunately, of, you know, sort of total tone deafness from the SEALs. And it's, you know, I think the answer to the question lies with, you know, what the book really is in many ways is a case study in failed leadership. And it's something that, you know, any corporation, you know, corporate structure would look at and could identify easily in the human, the the HR department would be able to identify these problems, right? It's not actually that difficult, but because they're so good and because they're so special and because we have put them up on a pedestal culturally, keep in mind that the SEALs are the single greatest recruiting tool that the Navy has. They get more recruitment from people wanting to join to become Navy SEALs, even though, a small fraction can actually make it, that they have a real value for the Navy and the military. And so it's insulated them from any kind of accountability. And I think that the end of the wars, such as they are in Afghanistan and Iraq, are probably as good a time as any to have a real look in the mirror. And for the Pentagon, the civilian leaders of the military and Congress to enforce some kind of accountability here to try to fix the problem.
Matthew Cole, investigative reporter at The Intercept, author of Code Over Country, The Tragedy and Corruption of SEAL Team 6. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks you so much, Sam.
All right, folks, quick break. And when we come back, Jack Crosby, writer at the Discourse blog, correspondent for Rolling Stone, just upon returning from several weeks in Ukraine. We'll be right back after this.
See.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland still on vacation, I should say. I guess I realized I forgot to say that up front. I was so excited to have Matt and, Bradley's been here, but have Matt back from his vacation. Also back, but not from a vacation, is Jack Crosby. He is a writer at the Discourse blog. Also a correspondent at Rolling Stone magazine, where he was sent on their behalf to report from Ukraine. Jack, welcome back.
Sam, thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Glad you made it through that safely. We just had a report of a U.S. reporter who was killed in Ukraine yesterday. I want to talk just sort of like broadly what you saw while you were there. And then we'll get into, there's a couple of pieces about the refugees and what you think NATO can actually do while you're there. But, give us a sense of, I guess, you know, I hopefully folks have been reading your reporting in Rolling Stone and saw you on MSNBC talking about what you saw. But give us a sense of, you know, now that you're back and I imagine still sort of adjusting to returning, what that experience was like. This is the first time you'd covered any type of war, right?
No. So I was in Ukraine in 2015. I'd covered this war before. So I went out after finishing graduate school. I went out to Ukraine in 2015, and I was out there for about sort of off and on for about 9 months. You'd get like a 90-day tourist visa, so I'd be out there for like 3 months, and then I'd go back and stay with my cousin in England for a couple of weeks and like get some R&R, and then I'd go back out there for another 3 months. This trip was drastically different. I had always wanted to do foreign reporting like that. I'd done reporting from Southeast Asia and stuff like that in the like early 2010s. It wasn't like completely my first rodeo, but then this trip out was definitely the intensity was different, I think. My first trip in 2015, it was very, the war at that point had kind of sort of like stagnated, like the front lines were very much set. It was one of these kind of post-Soviet like frozen conflicts that you see in Transnistria and until recently in Nagorno-Karabakh and even in Georgia and stuff like that. So that was kind of how it was from when I was there until 2015 until February the 24th. Of this year.
And so give us a sense of that, because, you know, we hear people, there are some who argue that what we're seeing now is a culmination of an 8-year conflict, that this is part of that, that it is an extension of it. I mean, how, when we hear, you know, 13, 14,000 people died since 2014, when did the bulk of that, of those deaths occurred? When you say, you know, the battle lines were basically stagnant, was it like every day we send over two shells, they send over two shells, and where were those shells going and coming from?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the bulk of the death in the initial conflict after Russia's sort of first invasion of Ukraine in 2014. Happened in the early, sort of in the first year of the war. But then it was, you know, it was 8 years kind of attrition. So in that first year of the war from sort of mid 2014 to mid 2015, there was a huge amount of fighting and a lot of like sort of changing and shifting in the front lines, like towns came under one control and then were recaptured and stuff like that. So it was a very fluid, you know, very hot war.
This is in the east of Ukraine and in the Donbass region, right?
Yeah, so this is all localized to that region of eastern Ukraine, centralized around the two major cities out there, which are Donetsk and Luhansk, which are both sort of like the capital cities of the respective oblasts, which is like a state, basically. So what had happened, you know, it, just in very brief, in 2014, kind of as a response to this popular revolution that had thrown out Ukraine's very much sort of pro-Russian government that was trying to it's getting into the roots of the entire like revolution, but essentially there were a lot of people in the country that did not want stronger economic ties to Russia, which was very much the direction that the government was taking them. Then you had this revolution, which is a very complicated and nuanced thing. There were all kinds of different groups with different aims in it, but it resulted in a new government. Russia didn't like that. They wanted to exert more power over Ukraine, which resulted in the annexation of Crimea. And then this sort of support of these nascent separatist groups. It's weird to say because there really wasn't like a hardline separatist movement in these areas before 2014. It was something that was like, I'm sure there was some actual support there, but a huge amount of it was kind of astroturfed. And then certainly a huge amount of the actual like military and gains that were made in this section of the country was Russian regular troops without insignia and, you know, advisors and everything like that coming through and essentially invading Ukraine at that time. So a lot of the death happened early then, but then there, after the lines had sort of solidified, it was, yeah, it was 8 years of attrition. It was the Ukrainians shelling the pro-Russian separatists and the pro-Russian separatists shelling the Ukrainians. And, you know, both sides, I think, were confirmed to have used cluster munitions. There were artillery strikes on civilians and stuff. But it was very much sort of like from 2015 onward, kind of a low flame of war, I think, that just consistently ate up lives, but wasn't like, you know, anything on the scale of what we're seeing right now.
You head over there, like, I think it was a week before the actual bombing started. Was that right?
Yeah, about 10 days, I think. I went over there on February 12th, and I think the war started February 24th, right?
Okay.
I'm not great with dates here. The days, like, it's honestly...
I understand.
It's just an enormous blur.
I would imagine. But I do recall that you, when you were heading over there, we were thinking that you would be able to, that you'd be back relatively soon, and hopefully you wouldn't have seen any war. Had you gone, you know, later, you that would not have been an open question. I ask that because we have a clip of the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, and Russian President Vladimir Putin. They met Saturday, 2 days ago. And I believe this translation is correct, though we translated it. But the argument is that this invasion was necessary as a preemptive strike. It just, when I hear preemptive, because I'm old, I just remember, you know, Condi Rice and, you know, Richard Pearl and what was it? Wolfstein. I can't even remember his name now. And of course, you know, Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and all of them talking about, you don't want the mushroom cloud to be a you don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. And that's where the preventative or preemptive war. And here is Lukashenko saying, you had to do this, President Putin, because it was prevented. Let's play this.
We weren't the ones to attack them because the Ukrainian army started shelling. When I visited last time, we were sitting in a helicopter and we were getting those reports. So they were the ones who started. And I will show you now from where they prepared an attack. Assault against Belarus. And if we didn't assault them preemptively, they would have assaulted our forces, Belarusian and Russian, who were part of the exercises. So we weren't the ones who started this assault. Our conscience is clear because, look, biological weapons, the largest nuclear power station, power plant, and they were ready to blow it up. Now we see what's happening in Chernobyl. You ask me to give them power, and they don't even need this. They don't even think about that.
As far as, you know, your reporting, you're not omniscient. You were there. You had a sense of it. Like, what part of that is true?
None of it.
Fair enough. I mean,
absolutely none of it. I mean, the Russian campaign to create a pretext to this war has been even lazier and more openly, transparently false than the U.S. campaign to create a run up to create a pretext for the invasion of Iraq. Like,
I think, you know, from my experience, the run up to the Iraq war was like a year and a half long. I mean, it was, there was real, a lot of effort put into this. This was like
an Iraq war speed run. It was basically like, it's absolutely absurd.
Give me a sense of what your take is on this bioweapon thing, because, I don't know that you would have necessarily any particular insights, but were you aware, at the very least, were you aware of that this was one of the the casus bellus. I'm saying this wrong, but one of the reasons why Putin went on and gave a speech as to why they were about to invade or why they had begun to invade Ukraine. It dealt with, you know, denazification. It dealt with corruption. It dealt with, a return, NATO threats. It dealt with a reconstituting of Russian Empire. Ukraine didn't really exist, et cetera, et cetera. Had you heard anything about, we also have to go in there because of the bioweapons that they're developing.
No, I mean, that was a new one. That's a new one that's cropped up in recent days. It's interesting. So some of the pretext to war that they gave have been like sort of long running conspiracy theories. I wrote about them in a piece for Rolling Stone before the war, actually, but there's all this stuff about like Russian genocide and things like that. And then they're like new investigations into like mass graves in Donetsk and Luhansk and stuff like that. And I didn't see those graves. That was like, I think a few months before I got there, but I spoke to a bunch of journalists that I knew that were out there and stuff. One especially, it's in that Rolling Stone piece, who had like been in the area where this sort of like conspiracy fermented, which was basically, it was a town in the early days of the war that was shelled, I think by both sides, or it was shelled by one side and then the other side, and it eventually came under like separatist control, and basically power had been knocked out for the entire town. There were all these bodies in the morgue, but no refrigeration. And so the local authorities, which at the time were the separatists, like buried them in a large mass grave outside. And then what they've done years later is like the Russian government, which knew through its separatist proxies that this grave was there, have said, we're opening up an investigation into this mass grave. It's going to prove like Ukrainian genocide, like et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like journalists who had been there at the time were like, everyone knew about this. This was exactly the situation that had happened. Like, this is an completely, you know, empty pretext. So there were some of these conspiracies that they've been talking about. And like the whole like Russian cultural genocide thing has been a running theme for the past 8 years. But this newer stuff, like the bio labs and things, I had not heard anything of that before. I mean, what he's saying about the nuclear power plant, like that's the nuclear power plant down in Zaporizhia, which is south of Dnipro or whatever. It's like, it's a nuclear power plant. Like, I don't know. His justification is like the Ukrainians were planning to blow it up. They were planning to like do Chernobyl again to their own power plant. It just like, it's ludicrous. I don't see why that would be
like me heading up to Indian power plant, just up the river on the Hudson River, and saying, I'm going to show Canada a thing or two and blowing it up. And everyone I know, it gets radiation poisoning.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's what they're alleging, basically. The biolabs thing, I don't know a huge amount about that, but I've seen some like really good sort of debunkings of that online from reputable sources. It appears that one of the main labs in question that they're talking about is up near the northeastern city of Kharkiv, where I was when the war started. And what it's basically, it was just like a biological research facility. We have them all over the place in the United States. They're in almost every country where, they're doing like research and they're handling sometimes certain pathogens and stuff like that. And I think the core of the conspiracy goes around that they were like destroying evidence or something like that. And it was all put down on paper. And then you have like actual, you know, genetic and biological scientists saying like, no, what the paper is it's literal just documentation that these scientists, when the city got invaded, were like properly disposing of hazardous samples of material and stuff like that. So that you don't, you know, someone doesn't crack a vial and then smallpox get. I don't think they had smallpox at that facility. But like Kharkiv, that whole area is like a massive university town. There's like 38 different universities there. There's medical schools. There's like, of course, they would have those kind of labs up there. And like maybe some of them got U.S. funding at some point. But these are not like, it's not like weapons research labs. This was all like things that was like public and above board and like on paper. So, this is... it's spaghetti at the wall, and they're just throwing it to see what sticks.
Now, are they now? Who is the audience here for this? Like when Lukashenko and Putin do this, and they are, you know, generating obvious, you know, fairly easily debunked lies by anybody who's on the ground and you know, had access to a TV, I guess, or news. Are they who is the audience? Is it for Belarusians and Russians as a way of maintaining political, you know, support or muting domestic dissent?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. Because you hear from people, and I've spoken to Ukrainians who have family members in Russia, and the especially now with this sort of recent purge of independent media outlets and stuff like that in Russia. But to a certain extent, it's basically Russia's media ecosystem is if an entire country only had access to like Fox News and Newsmax or whatever, and Trump were still in power and he fully controlled the agendas of all those networks, right? So it's if every single person in this country, the only news source that they had access to were like essentially state-owned and tools of the state that were feeding them a steady stream of disinformation and whatever. And I know there are watchers that are like, well, the U.S. news networks do propaganda and stuff like that. It's not even close to the same level. Like, I've spoken to people who were being bombed in Ukraine who were like on the phone with relatives in Russia, and their relatives were being like, we don't believe you. Like, we're like, it's not actually happening, you know? So all of this is to just keep those societal controls in place in these respective dictators' constituencies.
Right. I mean, I think this is an important point to make. Like, I don't think it's right for YouTube to be pulling down shows that are, you know, offering a different opinion on the Russian-Ukraine conflict. And particularly ones that are, you know, sort of frankly are smaller in some regard. I think we have a problem with YouTube with it. I don't want to go back in, you know, I don't want to relitigate that, but people should understand that when we say that that's problematic, it is not to, there is no comparison. It is, maybe a way of saying like, if this gets 20 times worse, or 100 times worse, it could look like something like what's actually ongoing in Russia. I mean, we're watching footage of people holding up blank signs in Moscow, literally a sign that just says like, nothing, and immediately getting arrested for holding up a sign. So the people should be aware of that. All right. So with that said, let's talk about, from your perspective, like there's a real tension here, right? And then we're seeing these images. We're watching people get bombed. A maternity ward in Mariupol, pregnant women being killed, which again, I also, you know, I hope that we can learn from this and develop some empathy that we can also apply to other conflicts, that ones in which we have actually, you know, more direct influence, frankly. But what do you think the U.S. response and the NATO response has been so far? And talk about that tension from what I would imagine the Ukrainians you were reporting on felt relative to the perspective that you have as an outsider.
Yeah. So, you know, I've tried to put this into words before, but it's when you speak to people in Ukraine, they want immediate NATO involvement. They want a no fly zone. They want the West to join the war against Russia. In their perspective and in their opinion, World War III is already happening. And the only difference between the two outcomes is whether or not the West gets involved while there are still Ukrainians alive, or whether the West gets involved after Ukraine has been essentially wiped off the map and it's Poland next. That is their perspective. And it's very easy to see how they get that perspective because, you know, they're being cluster bombed and artillery struck and, you know, massacred every single day. I think it's tough, as an outsider, you know, I don't really have anything that I can say to those people that makes it better when you speak to them, like in person, like there's literally nothing you can say. When you have the privilege of being able to take a step back from that, I think it's very clear to me and to a lot of people that, immediate direct NATO involvement in this conflict would be absolutely catastrophic. I think that there is still potentially a outcome to this that does not involve a wider war between Russia and NATO powers. I think we also sort of owe it to ourselves and to the Ukrainian people to be clear about what that means. And what that means is that they're going to die. And we're going to watch that happen. I think the Biden administration thus far has handled things about as well as they could have, at least since the war started. I think they've been smart to not do things like Obama did in Syria, to put red lines, to draw sort of arbitrary points in time when NATO involvement becomes secure. But I think also, like, as we're watching that happen, we need to be clear, like, whatever the U.S.'s role was in the lead up to this conflict, whatever. And, you know, I think this war was going to happen regardless of what NATO did in the build up to this. I think this war is very clear that this is what Putin, who has now totalitarian control over the Russian state, what he wanted. But I do think that we need to be honest with ourselves that all of the diplomatic mistakes that two administrations, three administrations, four, as far back as you want to go, of elected leaders in the U.S. have made, have contributed to the situation that we see right now. And that in some respect, all of the death that is going to happen, part of that blood is on our hands. It's of course, overwhelmingly more so on Vladimir Putin's hands. It was his decision to invade. I honestly am not sure in the past 5-10 years even what the West could have done to prevent that. But, you know, we're actors in this situation as well. And
I think it's important to say that for those people who say, like, now is not the time to mention this, people should know that, like, this critique about the expansion of NATO has been ongoing since prior to the expansion of NATO. I mean, these are critiques. You can go back. You can look at Moynihan making this argument. And there's a lot of things I don't like about Daniel Moynihan, but that this critique was out there since the early 90s, since the fall of the Soviet Union, and has been, repeated through those years. So if this is the first time you're hearing this critique, it is because it's the first time that we're actually paying attention to it. I think it's important to because I think you're right. I think we're about to basically sit on the sidelines and watch a horror unfold that we do not have the ability to stop. The only thing that we have an ability to influence is how it metastasizes. And so, all right, with that said, like, what is your sense of, I mean, this is the thing, you know, like the idea I'm talking about today, the sending another $200 million worth of weapons. If there is a sense that Putin is going to roll through Ukraine in as bloody a manner as he can, essentially, does it make sense to send weapons? Should the U.S. at this point say, okay, we're going to promise that Ukraine is never a member of NATO, regardless, you know, it, I don't know, I guess presumably call Putin's bluff on that accord. I don't know if it's right for the U.S. to, you know, if Ukraine wants to be a part of NATO, I don't know that it's right. I don't think they the U.S. should admit them. But to say, like, we're in charge of, you know, whether they're a member of EU or something to this effect, it's a very odd place to be in. Do you think that would end the fighting, though? I mean, like, what, like, I guess there's a critique that the U.S. should be going, calling Zelensky and saying, surrender, surrender now. What is your sense on that?
They're going to kill until they run out of bullets. There's no surrender. It doesn't matter. There's no, so I guess, I mean, it's tough. I understand the critiques about not like flooding Ukraine with weapons. We don't want to arm these right-wing militias. We don't, et cetera, et cetera. My sense from being there is that the Russian military has fully embraced a strategy similar to ones that they've used in Syria and in other conflicts. And they are going to, they're going to kill until they run out of bullets. And I think it's pretty much unarguable at this point that the U.S. weapons shipments that we have sent have made an enormous, like, strategic impact on those battlefields. I go back and forth on this constantly. I think with what we're seeing right now, it's like either I think the more the Ukrainian people are able to resist, potentially more of their own lives that they save. And I think also there's going to be this resistance no matter what. And if there's a lot of really thorny comparisons here, especially when you consider different factions and different conflicts that we've armed in the past and stuff like that. I don't necessarily see those as one-to-one comparisons. Like there's a very clear difference to me, I think, between providing weapons to the democratically elected government of a country that has been invaded and providing sort of ad hoc weapons deals to various shifting groups of non-state actors in countries that are currently in massive amounts of civil upheaval, right? Do I think it's definitely a problem if people with neo-Nazi tattoos are walking around with U.S. missile launchers? Like, yes, absolutely. But I think, at least in my experiencing, focusing on that micro, I'm not sure if that's enough of a reason. I don't know. I go back on this, but everything I have seen so far suggests that the Russian military and the Russian leadership is determined to inflict as much mass death and pain upon the Ukrainian people as they can.
I mean, don't they, from their perspective, have to now? Because yeah. Success, it seems to me, was always a change of leadership, a coup in Ukraine. There was going to be a change of leadership. It was going to be more sympathetic to Russia. That the expectation of that happening, I think, was wildly tin-eared. I mean, like the idea, the ease in which that was going to happen was why. But it seems to me that if Putin is going to control Ukraine, which seems to be the agenda here, they're going to have to. From their perspective, this isn't just about getting to the point of control. This is about maintaining control later, which means that they have to impose as much destruction as possible on the society, both physically and like in terms of just human toll, so that they can control this country later. It seems to me, if they are not going to end, like, I don't see they're either going to find it too costly to get that victory and they're going to settle with, we want independence for, you know, these places in the Donbass or whatever it is, or they're going to try and control the whole country. And either one involves the most amount of infliction of death and destruction as possible. And there's no there's no incentive for them to stop based upon their agenda.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see, I mean, even in the places that the Russians already control, in cities like Mykolaiv and Kherson and stuff like that, the few urban centers that they have been able to like establish consistent control over, which is shockingly like not a whole lot. If you look, there's a whole bunch of like maps floating around of like what the Russians actually control. What they actually control is they control a few urban population areas in the south. They control, you know, Donetsk and Luhansk, the separatist controlled areas that they already had on sort of on that existing front line, which is shifted a bit. They've captured a few towns here and there. And then they control bits and pieces of like major highways and like arteries into Ukraine, like down sort of from Belarus down to outside of Kyiv. Some of the highways around like almost encircling, but not quite Kharkiv and things like that. They're not holding large amounts of land. They're not holding large amounts of towns. They're not doing anything like this. And in the towns that they do hold, like, there are street protests every single day of people that are coming out and protesting against the Russian occupation. And they're oftentimes, it seems like, you know, they're not taking some pains to not outright massacre those protesters immediately. But they're, you know, they're doing everything else. They're shooting people that try and leave. They're bombing humanitarian convoys, et cetera, et cetera. I think they know, like, they can't effectively control this country. So the only other option is that they try and kill it first, kill as many people as they can. If it's similar to Syria, if they depopulate areas through indiscriminate shelling, then they can control them because there's no people there. They can say, we control Mariupol. You saw this in a small town earlier today. There's a small town 40 miles outside of Donetsk called Volnovakha. It used to be a checkpoint town in the border. It was one of the towns you would go through if you're crossing over from Ukrainian held side to the rebel held side, which I did many times in 2015, back when the separatist areas were still allowing independent press in. I lived out there for a month and a half, so I've reported on both sides of this conflict line. You go through Volnovakha. It's a small town, about 20,000 people. The Russians now claim that they control Volnovakha, but in reality, it's basically wiped off the map. There's not an intact building in the town. The lives of the vast majority of its residents are unclear. Who knows what happens to them? There's no telecommunication, there's no water, there's no anything like this. So you're seeing that happen in Mariupol, but there's smaller towns like this one in Volnovakha that the Russians control, but in reality are just gone. That's their plan for the country.
When they start to encircle Kyiv, are they, do you think they're planning for an assault, or do you think that they're planning to essentially try and just strangle the city by way of starvation, by way of my understanding is that they're attacking water supplies. Based upon their effectiveness in fighting the Ukrainians at this point, it seems like their next option is just to sort of wait. If they can get, you know, supplies for their own military, they just wait.
Yeah. So I think what they're doing right now, there actually haven't been significant Russian advances in the past few days. They pulled back some of their units that were near Kyiv. I'm not like super huge on the grander like military analysis and tactics. What I've generally seen is that they think that the Russian forces there, having been stymied in this like sort of swift assault on the city, are kind of regrouping, and then they're planning that next move. I think the best predictions that I have seen is that it is going to be some form of like kind of protracted siege of the city. But I honestly, it's been so hard to predict what they're going to do. But from everyone I've spoken to and everything I've read, it looks like, you know, this is sort of a brief respite as they're regrouping, and then it's going to get a whole lot worse for Kyiv. They're going to, continue shelling and bombarding and bombing and kind of throwing as much as they can out at it. I guess the question for me basically is what the resources of the Russian military actually are and how long they can keep this up. They're already asking China for supplies. They're already conscripting people in Russia. They're already having you know, it does not seem particularly well organized. And while there's a lot of like power there, I don't know how long they can do that for, but it seems like they're going to do it as long as they can.
Lastly, Chernobyl, what is your sense as to what is going on with Chernobyl? I don't sort of understand what the idea is with that.
So I think I don't want to speak too soon. I think Chernobyl is kind of like sort of like red herring. Like the nuclear stuff is not as big of an issue there. Like
my understanding is it's not as dangerous as, you know,
as that region. No,
think at this point, yeah. Because the, you know, it has been 40 years.
It's been dormant for ages. There's like a massive like metal enclosure over the reactor itself. Like there were some issues where they were like, the fighting there has like kicked up like radioactive dust and like the power was out at the facility or something like that. Obviously if they drastically mismanage it or someone like starts dropping bombs on the old like Chernobyl power plant, you know, itself, like that's bad. That could be an issue. I think Chernobyl's significance more so is just a like conventional strategic one. It's a big sort of area of built up with roads and stuff through Pripyat and stuff like that. That is, it's right on the border with Belarus, directly north of Kyiv. So it's just an area that the Belarusians and Russians want to control so that they can control, as I've said, like these main arterial roads and these highways that let them project force and get like armor and tanks and stuff immediately down to the outskirts of Kyiv. So I'm if we're worried about like nuclear risks in the country, I'm much more worried about the power plant down on the Dnieper River. I think it's a little bit southwest of Zaporizhia than I am of, you know, the old dormant stuff in Chernobyl.
All right. Let me add one more question. And this is, I guess, is sort of a big one. And I apologize, for pretending the last question was the last one. There's two dynamics here, right? One is that the question of, is there an off ramp for Putin that is, I mean, you know, he's sort of on the highway already, but is there an off ramp where, you know, that this endeavor where he can go and say, this was always about just getting independence for these, you know, these regions in Donbass and to the extent that there isn't, and it really becomes a quagmire for Putin, right? I mean, because we've already talked about like there is going to be there essentially controlling Ukraine is not going to be something that seems like it's going to be viable for any, you know, any time in the future. That I wonder how much of an impetus there is at one point when there is a realization that this conflict cannot be avoided. And we've talked about, you know, the idea of arming people because they're not going to stop in terms of killing, and that it, the Russians. How much of that is like, were there war hawks in your mind in this country, in NATO, broadly speaking, who said, this is an opportunity, one that we didn't necessarily court, but we didn't think would arise. But this is an opportunity to, you know, in many respects, this is how the Soviet Union ended with Afghanistan. This is an opportunity to end, you know, maybe to do a Russian reset type of thing. How much of that do you think is out there?
I mean, I think there's definitely people there's probably definitely some horrible people out there that were hoping for that situation beginning. And you know, unfortunately for everyone in Russia and everyone in Ukraine, I think that's already happened. I think the Russian state, as we know it, is finished. I don't think that there is, I don't really see an off-ramp for Putin. I guess he could say like our limited military operation, because that's how they've been phrasing it, has concluded. We've secured independence and freedom for the Russian-speaking peoples of the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts. were pulling back from Kiev after sending a strong message to the Nazi government in charge of Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. These are the new borders of Donetsk and Luhansk. We'll abide to a ceasefire based on those. Maybe. I hope that happens. But I honestly don't, I don't know. It wasn't a logical or rational decision that caused them to invade in the first place, right? And I think the consequences that have been leveled against Russia have been disastrous, both militarily and economically. I think there's a lot to critique as well as to the West's use of broad sanctions that are going to harm the Russian economy in general and the Russian people, as opposed to much more targeted and focused sanction. You know, we didn't sanction Putin himself immediately because, like, world leaders are, you know, technically a hands-off zone or something like that. And we're only now getting around to, like, sanctioning a whole bunch of the oligarchs and stuff
after
like that.
After they've had the opportunity to store, you know, whatever it is, convert all of their holdings into diamonds and put it into some, you know, safe somewhere or something, whatever.
Exactly. I think there's a lot to critique about the U.S. response to that, but I think the response, as it has been from the U.S. and the Western and the European community, has just absolutely thrashed the concept and notion of Russia and Russia as a state. And I don't, especially if this war drags on for years and things like that, and they keep sinking resources that they don't have into this, like, yeah, it's going to break them. And I'm sure that there are war hawks in Washington that are pleased about that. You know, personally, I absolutely don't think it would be a bad thing if Putin's regime came down. But I wish that there were a way that could happen that would have less fallout on, you know, Russian people.
Human suffering.
Exactly. But I honestly don't know. I don't see an off-ramp to that. And I especially don't see an off-ramp to this conflict that doesn't end up with a huge amount more suffering being leveled on the primary people that are experiencing it, which is the Ukrainians. You know, it is bad for Russians that, you know, but like having your bank accounts all messed up and McDonald's closed down is not the same thing as, you know, cluster bombs in your living room. That's not to excuse the US's actions in certain ways or say that like sanctions are good, but there's always levels to the pain that people experience in situations like this.
Jack Crosby, thank you so much. Very happy, obviously, that you made it back safely. Really impressive work while you were over there. You know, there's a piece we didn't even get to it, but I would encourage people to go check out the piece you wrote on the Discourse blog. Was it today or yesterday? I don't know about NATO as a
Friday, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, to absorb immigrants or refugees, I should really say, if we want to help mitigate the human suffering in some way, that's the place to do it. We'll put a link to that, obviously. Nice to have you back on the AM Quickie. There you go. Right.
Yeah.
You slide right back in. all right, man. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
All right, folks, that was on Friday. Go back and read some of Jack's stuff. And obviously, I would imagine he's going to be writing about Ukraine for some time. Well, sort of broke format a little bit today. We had enough. It was a 45-minute fun half. The show was originally, when we launched this show, it was supposed to be a 45-minute fun half and a 45-minute free half.
Myla only promises 50 minutes on the teaser to the public.
Oh, podcast. 50 minutes?
50 minutes.
All right. Well, Myla, they gave away an extra 5 minutes. It wasn't hers to give away. That was like the nascent. And she must have recorded that like 10 years ago. I think we recorded that like eight years ago, 10 years ago.
It's before my time.
Before your time. Before it was like the nascent beginnings of her
she's probably younger than Saul or
her Depop. Oh yeah, she was younger than Saul. Yeah. That has been the weird thing is Saul just had his birthday and he is now older than Myla was when Saul was born. but I am realizing, and I sort of knew at the time, almost two only childs. Because I get news for you. When if you're not aware of what happens when some girls turn 16, but like she's gone. She has more interaction with like the fridge, or you know,
it's a good age for the fridge.
Or even the dishwasher, which she barely has any interaction with, than she does with me. I am just like, I think there are times when she's actually surprised that I'm actually talking. Anyways, 646-257-3920. We may get a couple of phone calls in. I'll take your IMs. We'll do a couple of clips. It's called The Fun Half, ladies and gentlemen. Also, Majority Live. We've got our live show now. It's less than 2 weeks away.
Oh, wow.
Yep. I think Jack's going to be there. I think. And the whole extended Majority Report family, at least the ones that live in Brooklyn, will be there. We may have some other special guests and some submissions from some of our, you know, longtime callers and IMers. And of course, you see, I mean, that's the thing I think is going to be really fun. This is like, you know, I originally thought this was going to happen in Boston January 16th. And then now here's the other thing. Nobody cares the way I experience it. Right. I mean, it's the audience cares about how they experience it, but I don't have that ability. This is really about how I experience it. So this is about me seeing a bunch of you. Like I got a little bit of that the other night at the Bituation Room. Like, you know, it's all like Train Boy. A couple other listeners of the program who immediately they say their name, and all I do is see their IM handle.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing to try to recalibrate when a person is introducing themselves and it's like a username that you've seen.
All I see is like the bubble on the screen. But this is going to be a way of like us celebrating that we can all be together. And, so Majority Live. But my point was you can stream it if you're not going to be there. And you can go to Majority Live, click through on the Brooklyn show. You can stream it. You'll get a streaming thing. It'll be available after you've streamed it to be able to watch it for you if you purchased a streaming ticket. And here's the deal. The streaming tickets are like very reasonably priced at like $12.50. However, this is like a Crazy Eddie commercial. I just went insane one night. And it was like, let's put in a coupon code for more than 50% off. $7.50 off the streaming. So $5. But you can only get that coupon code if you go to amquickie.com, sign up for the AM Quickie. And then bonus, I mean, actually, this is really the prize. Corey and Jack, who you just heard from, produce an amazing newsletter every morning that is emailed to you. And you get some of the top stories of the day. So check it out, amquickie.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And freshly back from his European vacation, Matt Leck has a new a travel podcast out.
Hey, I should do it. I am going to be flying solo because David Griscom and I are staggering our vacation. So I will be doing Left Reckoning this week, Friday. We'll be having Carl Baer on to talk Ukraine, Russia. And I actually haven't caught up with what David did last week. I know he had Natalie Shore on and Ben Burgess. I will be probably listening to that before I prepare the next week's show. But I'll be going into A.C. Townley, who was he was a socialist, but then he decided to leave socialism behind in North Dakota because it wasn't quite taking. So he started a farm populist party by driving around in a Model T, and we'll be going into how that sort of movement created the state grain elevator and the state bank that, by the way, paid for my travels in undergrad. and how he was thrown in prison for opposing World War I, and then became anti-communist kind of crank. But anyway, that will be on Wednesday at Left Reckoning, so check that out, folks.
See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Fun
Hat.
Matt.
Drew.
Fun
Hat.
What is up, everyone?
Fun Hat.
Nomi Key.
You did it.
Fun Hat.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun Hat.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop. Talking oh, for wow. a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go start watching.
Who libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3-8.
9-11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$6,543 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about yeah. you is just like every day, all day, like yeah. everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow.
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.